Wherever you're listening, if you're in Australia, you're on Aboriginal land. At the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia, we pay respects to the elders and acknowledge their ongoing custodianship of the country where we made this podcast and of the country you're listening to it on. Radio has been a dominant cultural force in Australia for more than 100 years. It's the grandmother of home entertainment and of what we now think of as the mass media. Radio means different things to different people. For some, it's a reliable constant in their everyday lives.
Radio has meant a huge amount to me throughout my life. I think I've always listened to radio. Different things at different times, depending on where you are and what sort of headspace you're in. But I think that's what radio does really well, is it gives you options to be engaged, distracted, comforted sometimes, all of those things. But mostly, it's just really nice to have on in the background a lot of the time. Sometimes you just want to know someone else is there.
For others, it was the soundtrack of their childhood.
My mother, who was also a news junkie, listened to radio. She'd listen to a lot of talkback. She'd listen to John Laws, for instance. So I grew up listening to commercial radio as much as to ABC radio.
Or the first glimpse into a bigger, ever-expanding world.
I used to go to sleep listening to the radio in the evening quite often. I remember listening on my crystal set late at night that Czechoslovakia was being invaded and there were tanks rolling down the streets in Prague. I remember that very clearly because that was a very big deal at the time.
While the pioneering amateur station 2CM had been regularly broadcasting music for audiences in Sydney since 1921, Sydney's 2SB is the first station officially licensed by the Australian government to hit the airwaves. Picture this. It's the evening of November 23, 1923. At exactly 8 p.m, music comes flooding through the speakers. The first program included everything from Robert Schumann's Two Grenadiers to Camille Saint-Saëns' The Swan from The Carnival of the Animals. Only a few hundred people may have heard it. Enthusiasts with their crystal sets and headphones, households of early adopters who'd already installed a big clunky radio unit in their living rooms. But that moment marked the birth of Australia's love affair with radio. And while the 2SB call sign no longer exists, that was the beginning of ABC Radio Sydney. In this podcast, we'll be looking back at the past 100 years of radio broadcasting in Australia. It's a survivor, radio, adapting and evolving in response to any number of cultural and technological threats, inventing new models of programming, advertising, and celebrity, helping to amplify voices on the margins of society, while at the same time bringing the nation's commuters home every day with all the hits of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. From crystal sets to podcasts, we're a nation of audiophiles. So settle back as we celebrate the century of radio and ask the question, you've tuned into Who Listens to the Radio, brought to you by the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia. I'm Patrick McIntyre, and this is Episode 1, Transmission Statement. Okay, let's start at the very beginning, the beginning of the 20th century. Like a lot of familiar household technologies, radio was originally invented for a totally different purpose. Our team of curators at the National Film and Sound Archive has been digging deep through our radio archives to bring together our digital exhibition, Radio 100, which you can find on our website.
My name is Torsten Kading. I'm the Senior Curator of Acquisition Programs at the National Film and Sound Archive. Radio wasn't actually designed for what we ended up using it for. It was designed primarily for shipping and to enable ships to communicate. That was even more so in the wake of the Titanic sinking as well. We're really capturing the expressions of Australian culture and popular culture. Radio is a fantastic way to do that because it's so immediate and it speaks so much to the time. Most radio isn't designed to last for 100 years. It's designed to go out, have an immediate impact and reflect the culture. So for us, it's really fascinating to be able to collect that and then look back on it because it's not telling timeless stories. It's not, as I say, designed to be re-listened to over and over again. It's just for the moment. I think we get our, in some ways, our truest cultural representation of the past.
As the 20th century dawned, the driving force behind the inception and operation of radio technology was the Marconi Company, formed by visionary Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi. Here's Bridget Griffin Foley, a director of research and innovation at Macquarie University.
He was an Italian nobleman, and he had found a way in the 1890s to transmit telegraph messages without connecting wires.
Guglielmo Marconi, now credited as the inventor of radio, found little enthusiasm for his creation in Italy. So he set sail for England, arriving in 1896 with his telegraph machine and the hope that the UK would be more receptive. And it was. England embraced both Marconi and his invention. The British Marconi Company launched its first radio station in Chelmsford, pioneering and then dominating ship-to-shore communication. So how did radio evolve from a maritime tool to the first form of electronic home entertainment? Again, it was Marconi who got the ball rolling. After World War I, he started thinking about radio for cultural uses. In 1920, from its base in Chelmsford, Marconi's company broadcast a performance by Australian opera superstar Dame Nellie Melba that could be heard for hundreds of miles. Within years, radio stations were popping up all over the globe. While Marconi is the biggest name on the world stage, Australia's approach to radio was very much driven by maverick Ernest Fiske, here remembered by his grandson, Peter.
So I'm Peter Fiske. My father was Ernest Kelvin Fiske, who was Sir Ernest Fiske's first son. My grandfather, Ernest Fiske, was born in 1886. I remember he was a little bit eccentric. He lived in Roseville at that time, and we used to visit him. And being 6 years old, one had to be on one's absolute best behaviour at his lunch table or dinner table with Lady Fiske, his wife. And I do remember being impressed by the way he managed his tea. He would have several cups, empty cups, in front of him with the teapot, and he would pour his tea into one of them and then pour it into another cup and then pour it into another cup in order to get the temperature just how he liked it. And of course, being 6 years old, I thought everybody must have done this. And I remember being surprised when other people just poured their tea into their cup and drank it. So he was eccentric.
In his youth, Ernest Fiske was just another kid in England trying to get by, selling newspapers at a railway station when he was a teenager, then working as a telegraph operator at a local post office.
Because that was a major means of communication by Morse code down wires. And he was actually a pretty good telegraphist. And by the time he was about 20 or so, he decided to attend what was known as the Marconi School of Wireless. And at that time, what radio or wireless, as it was called, on ships was in its early stages, and it was very, very new technology. It was complex and not widely understood. And the Marconi Company would provide for a ship not only the equipment to receive and transmit messages, but also the operators. And in order to be an operator, you had to go through the Marconi School. And so he went through that school and did very well at that, and then spent the next few years sailing around the world on various ships as a ship's radio operator. And after some years doing that, the company recognized that he was actually a very bright, well-spoken young man, and they moved him into jobs where he was actually demonstrating the equipment and then into sales. And he eventually ended up in Australia as part of the Marconi's company's agency in Australia. That was about 1910, 1912, something like that. Then the Marconi Company decided to merge its Australian branch with the German Telefunken Company in 13 or so to form what became known as Amalgamated Wireless of Australasia.
By 1916, Fisk was managing director of Amalgamated Wireless Australasia, or the AWA, and he would shortly make history.
And in 1919, Fisk arranged, when he was giving a public lecture in Sydney for the Royal Society of New South Wales, he and AWA arranged for the national anthem, God Save the King, to be broadcast across Sydney, and so the attendees at his lecture witnessed, heard, what really was a very early radio broadcast put on especially for them.
As you can imagine, the audience was said to have marvelled exceedingly.
We interrupt this broadcast for a science update. What is a radio wave? Let's dive into the fascinating world of radio waves, those invisible messengers of the electromagnetic spectrum that keep us connected and entertained. So picture this. It's the late 1800s and James Clerk Maxwell drops the bombshell of electromagnetic theory in 1867, predicting the existence of radio waves. Fast forward to 1887 and Heinrich Hertz proves Maxwell right by cooking up some radio waves in his lab. Marconi steps into the scene in the 1890s, crafting the first practical radio gear. Suddenly, we're hurtling towards the 20th century and radio becomes more than just a cool experiment. It hits the commercial stage around 1900, and by 1912, we're officially calling these waves radio waves, ditching the old school Hertzian wave. Now, let's talk sources. Lightning, crackles, and cosmic wonders like the sun, galaxies, and nebulas are natural rock stars belting out radio waves. On the flip side, our tech-savvy species joins the party with transmitters, gadgets that shoot out radio waves by wrangling oscillating electric currents through antennas. Imagine these waves as streams of photons, the uncharged VIPs of the particle world. When they reach a receiver's antenna, they create tiny oscillating currents that the receiver eagerly picks up. It's like a symphony of electromagnetic harmony orchestrated by scientists and engineers throughout history. So, whether it's a lightning bolt composing a cosmic melody or your favourite radio station beaming tunes through the air, radio waves are the unsung heroes of modern communication, broadcasting, and navigation. Tune in, because the world of radio waves is as captivating as it is essential to our connected lives. Back to regular programming.
The airwaves were crackling with all sorts of experiments conducted by businesses, advocates, and enthusiastic amateurs, all leading to that first official Australian broadcast in 1923. Unfortunately, nothing survives of these early broadcasts. But in our archives, we hold what we believe are the two oldest recordings of radio in Australia. Here's Amy Butterfield, a curator on NFSA's Radio 100 project.
The first thing that strikes you when looking at the earliest days of radio, as is the case with the earliest days of film or television, is that not much survives, especially in the case of radio because it's not a recorded medium. The earliest recording of a live radio broadcast in Australia, we believe, is the 1932 Melbourne Cup call.
This is the Australian Broadcasting Commission transmitting through the stations of the national network from the Flemington Racecourse.
He's come round the outside of the field and looks to have them all well beaten. Yoramba wins it all right. He's coming away from Peter Pan, who's finishing on a bit strongly. No, Peter Pan might get there. It's going to Peter Pan will win it. Peter Pan will win it. Peter Pan wins from Yoramba with Shadow King third.
The next oldest recording we have is a very short, it's about 3 minutes, sound recording of a commentary of a boxing match that happened in Melbourne the same day. which really surprised me when it took me a long time because we didn't have a, we had a year, which we couldn't be sure about.
There goes the gong for the beginning of the 10th round. Both boys come up to the centre of the ring. They shake hands. And the fight is on. Jones leads with a straight left and connects with right and left jabs to the body. Lawler counters with his southpaw right to the head and lashes out with that left to the body. Good punch. He's got Jones going back. Lawler rushes Jones to the ropes.
It was March 1932. So I had to trawl through a bunch of newspapers. Trove made that possible. And we were able to find a record of the match in question. And it wasn't a famous match at all. I've maybe found half a dozen just quick newspaper lines about it. But I am confident that it was recorded on the 1st of November 1932, a matter of hours after the Melbourne Cup, which sort of makes sense because they probably used the same technology. The Melbourne Cup call was conveyed, I think, by telephone line to a radio station in Sydney. It assumes this importance because it's one of the oldest radio broadcasts that survives. But, you know, the history of radio is there's 9 years between the beginning of broadcasting in Sydney. Melbourne is 1924, Adelaide 1924, the other cities a bit later.
As in the early days of film and television, the early innovators weren't necessarily aware of the significant impacts their work would have in the future. They're just mucking around, trying out new things, not keeping meticulous recordings and copies for future generations.
So there's nearly a decade where no actual radio broadcast recordings survive. So you've sort of got to come at it from multiple angles and use different kinds of evidence to sort of build a picture.
Let's get back to Ernest Fisk and his AWA.
The dominant figure, I think, by the 1920s in the radio industry in Australia was Ernest Fisk.
In cooperation with the Marconi Company, they set up a wireless station to communicate directly with the rest of the world just northwest of Melbourne at a place that became known as Fiskville. I think there were some egos involved there. It was named after the boss. But that was an extraordinary system of communication to actually be able to directly send radio messages from Australia to England and back again on a commercial basis and on a routine basis. It was a very big system, had enormous antennas. You can still see the bases of them out there. And it was a huge technical achievement and operated incredibly until 1969.
By the 1920s, there were amateurs who were experimenting with technology, with basic receivers, which were called crystal sets. But there was no sort of clear commercial or government or regulatory plan for wireless broadcasting.
VK2, AQQ in Cremorne.
And tuning the band for call. Okay, somebody, please.
Oh, well, we're still testing here. What do you think of this program, the pattern on it?
This recording you are about to hear was made by Graham Conway.
I like the snow, don't you?
Yes, especially around Cosby.
Torsten Kading says that another turning point in 1923 was the government stepping in to regulate the lawless radioscape.
The government, through the Postmaster General at the time, legislated to put out licenses, and that's where, I suppose, formal commercial radios took over from those first amateur radio broadcasters.
The initial solution to airwaves regulation was the sealed set system. Each radio receiver was locked onto just the one station. Not surprisingly, this limited system didn't really work for broadcasters or their audiences, and it didn't last long. It was replaced in 1924 with the introduction of two different kinds of broadcasting license, Class A and Class B. Class A stations were paid for by license fees, paid by listeners, and collected by the Australian government. And Class B licences were available to anyone who thought they could make a go of it. Businesses, churches, trade unions. This cunning plan avoided the pitfalls observed in the nascent radio industries in the UK and the US. The UK being a government monopoly in the form of the BBC, and the US being a wild frontier of commercial anything goes. Ultimately, in Australia, the Class A stations evolved into the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, and the Class B licences into the commercial sector as we know it today, funded by advertising. Australians took to radio fast. Amy Butterfield reflects on the surprising speed of Australia's commercial broadcasting, a momentum fuelled in part by the indefatigable Fisk.
What surprised me about radio is how much quicker Australia was to get it started. Like, I think America was the first, and they had commercial broadcasting, I think, from late 1920. The BBC first started in 1922. I think Australia was before other countries in Europe, whereas with television, we were so slow off the bat. Like, most countries in Europe certainly long had television before we did.
We were even slower when it came to the internet, but we'll get to that in a later episode. Fisk's prescience also extended to the potential for radio to make the world smaller. He said in 1923, "No scientific discovery offers such great possibility for binding together the parts of our far-flung empire and for developing its social, commercial, and defence welfare." Remember back then, commercial flights between the UK and Australia didn't start until 1935, and a one-way trip took 12 days. The dream was that radio would also help to bridge the gap between the city and the country.
That it might help bring city joys such as concerts, entertainment, enlightening experiences to more isolated rural areas. An early periodical called Wireless Weekly actually speculated in about 1922 about how radio might connect this land of magnificent distances. So in Australia, because the population was quite small and so dispersed, there was a real challenge for commercial interests, but also regulatory and government bodies to think about how could radio reach people geographically, how could the transmitters be strong and powerful enough, and how could it be commercially viable given how dispersed the population was. Early broadcasts were heard by experimenters, but there weren't thousands and thousands of listeners in the 1920s. Radio sets were reasonably expensive. Licences were quite expensive.
As ever, the promise was there, but the practicalities were daunting. As Secretary and Director of the Postmaster General's Office, Harry Brown, put it in 1928, the problem was to provide a reasonable service to 6 million people scattered over 3 million square miles of a continent. The very same problem that dogged the rollout of television, telephone, mobile phone, internet and broadband in the decades to follow. But for now, back to the 1920s. What were those early radio receivers like?
Initially, the receivers were simply these crystal sets that were listened to by earphones. But as the 1920s progressed, radio manufacturers, including AWA, produced radio sets, and they tended to be large and cumbersome, quite expensive, big pieces of technology set in inevitably brown wooden furniture that was in the living room. So the pictures that you would see in radio periodicals in the 1920s and into the 1930s showed these pieces of furniture and the family, the mother, the father, the children, sometimes grandparents as well, gathered around the radio set.
Mum and Dad invariably in control of the dial. And what was actually on the radio in the early years?
A lot of the material, and some of it's really typecast, I suppose. The material that was broadcast during the day was soap operas, essentially, that were designed with a female audience specifically. But many of those, as soap operas do, attract, you know, all sorts of people to them.
I Oh, hello, Darby.
Oh, Joan, uh-huh. I think that Jimmy Brown is well on the way to getting another job as the warder of the jail.
Oh, darling, that wouldn't be very pleasant, would it?
No, not very safe either. 10 prisoners have just broken out.
Good gracious, did they sound the alarm?
No, dear, they sent for the doctor. They broke out in measles.
Oh, darling, you are stupid.
So it was everything from comedies to soap operas, exactly what you would expect on television in terms of television content.
Dogs is the nicest people. Mama Lena of Ambler, PA, looks at her record family of 23 children.
Television took on those shows off radio. So all of the sorts of dramas, sitcoms, comedies, melodramas, soap operas that you get on television have their roots in radio. That's exactly what the radio series were all about. Everything from children's ones like Superman through to ones, the more melodramatic ones like Porsche Faces Life.
The Civic Floor Covering Company, specialists in all floor coverings and furnishings, presents today's installment of
Porsche Faces Life. A story taken from the heart of every woman who has ever dared to love completely.
Bridget Griffin Foley unveils a fascinating aspect of the era, the occult. The uncanny ability to pick up disembodied voices floating in the air fueled the belief that radio could be used to communicate with spirits from the beyond.
So as radio develops in the early part of the 20th century, spiritualists thought that it might be possible to use seances to communicate with the living by spelling out coded messages through short tapping noises. So the hope that coded messages could be relayed through short tapping noises in seances is quite similar to the sort of Morse code tapping that is used in telegraphy. In the 1910s, there's an increasing popular association between telecommunications and the invisible spirits, disembodied communication. And radios were used by some people in the hope that you might be able to make contact with extraterrestrials, particularly Martians. There's a real interest in this in the 1910s and 1920s. Ernest Fiske himself thought that it might be possible to communicate with the dead through radio. And this was a belief that wasn't just unique to him. After the losses of World War I and World War II, with the losses of so many young men in particular, there were grieving people such as Fiske, he lost one of his own sons in World War II, who thought desperately that it might be possible to communicate with the dead using wireless telegraphy. There certainly was a great deal of interest in these sorts of possibilities for early decades of the 20th century.
The whole sound recording thing, I think, has always been something which has tended towards that sort of spiritualism aspect. A lot of people thought that there was something inherently magical about being able to actually record sounds and voices in particular, and then to be able to broadcast them as well.
Interestingly, the American magician Harry Houdini, he was a skeptic who actually used his fame to try to expose the wireless-related tricks that were behind some sort of fake mediums and spirit trumpets of the 1920s.
The belief in the mystical powers of radio gave rise to acts like the Piddingtons, an Australian couple who first showed off their alleged telepathic abilities on Melbourne radio station 3KZ in 1947. Sydney and Leslie Piddington were a hit. They would later share their talents to an audience of millions on the BBC.
They started out on radio using the technology in order to be able to essentially do what we'd now call illusion and magic tricks, which once again I think is fascinating to use radio for that.
In this excerpt from the show's only surviving Australian episode, Sydney attempts to transmit to Leslie the names of horses competing in the 1947 Melbourne Cup.
Broadcasting service, station 3Ks in Melbourne, the time is 7:30, and Patterson's Proprietary Limited, Australia's most progressive home furnishers, present The Piddington Show.
And now, here is Piddington.
Thank you. I thought, as this is Cup Eve and the Melbourne Cup is in almost all our minds, it would be appropriate to commence this evening's demonstration by attempting to project the names of Cup horses to my wife. I will now ask Howard Craven to tell you what has been done so far.
We might consider the audience naive for falling for these tricks, but a science fiction writer, Arthur C. Clarke, famously said, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic."
I think nowadays we would be really skeptical about it because we know how technology can be manipulated and all of those sort of things. But that wasn't the case for them. They were really able to fascinate people. And in fact, I think I was just looking recently, there are still people trying to figure out how they did some of the performances that they did on radio.
Judge number one, Commander Huskisson, would you please stand next to Leslie on the other side of the studio? Now, I want you to assure the listening audience that from where you stand with Leslie, that it is impossible for her or for you to see the front of this blackboard.
It's impossible for her to see the front of the blackboard.
Thank you. And now, if you would come over here and remove the curtain from the blackboard.
And now, get ready to step into the 1930s, often dubbed the golden years of radio. For decades, that big, glowing box on the shelf would be every family's primary source of news, music, sport, comedy, and drama, amongst all the advertising. But already, on the horizon, a threat is approaching.
There's no doubt that television had a big impact on the radio serial.
As television is kind of supplanting radio as a medium, and transistor radios are coming in and people are listening to radio in their cars or on the beach, there's less of that people sitting down and listening to a half-hour radio drama.
This has been Who Listens to the Radio, brought to you by the National Film and Sound Archive. Thank you to our guests, Bridget Griffin Foley, Peter Fisk, and our science communicator Andy True, and to NFSA curators Torsten Kading and Amy Butterfield. If you've enjoyed Who Listens to the Radio, don't forget to rate or review wherever you get your podcasts. You can visit the Radio 100 digital exhibition at nfsa.gov.au.